Hey everybody, my name is Danny Dumas and this is the Earn Your Title podcast. Before I start today's episode, I want to say thank you. I just crossed the 5,000 download mark and it's awesome. I saw that number and it's truly hard to believe that happened, and it only happened because of you. So thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to speak to you. Hopefully you're getting something out of it and hopefully you're taking action. When I started this, I didn't want it just to be putting ideas out into the world. I wanted to put ideas out into the world that would cause you to take action. So if you're a better husband, father, or leader today because of this podcast, thank you for investing your time. Thank you for taking action, and I hope this is improving your life. So I have full plans to keep this going. I feel like it's been successful, and yeah, so thank you. Today's episode, we're going to talk about one of the more important skills when it comes to being a husband, father, or leader, and that is influence. It is the ability to change someone's mind. And if you're, if you have a job, and most of us hopefully have jobs, and you work with other people, you realize how important it is to be able to influence or to help change someone's mind. If you're a parent, this is probably the most important skill, is to be able to change your kids' minds or get them to see things your way. And I recently just read a book called Mind Stuck, and it really challenged the way I thought about influencing and maybe demanding change as a parent sometimes. And I wanted to go over three scenarios that I think as husbands, fathers, and leaders, we really need to hone our craft, become professionals, and really excellent at these things. The first one is to realize that the mind that needs to change the most is probably yours. And this is hard, right? To realize that there is 100% chance that everything I believe cannot be right. That there's something that I hold as a value, that I hold to be true, and that it is not. And I think that's where becoming a great influencer really, really starts, is to realize that, man, I'm flawed, that my thinking is not correct, and I need to be willing to change. And sometimes there's some thoughts, some things that we hold so dearly that if we were ever to let them go and to decide that that is something that I was wrong, that we failed, or that somehow that's an insult to our character, that we didn't hold fast to something that we believed was true. And I want to encourage you, and I'm looking at myself right in the mirror saying, you need to be willing to change. That needs to be something that you try to do on a daily basis, maybe, that you're constantly thinking through the things you believe, comparing them to what reality is, and trying to decide, is this true? I'll give you two stories of how I changed my mind and why it was important, why it was hard. And before I do that, I want to start off in this book, they discuss the differences in the way we think. And we have two minds. One is the instinctive mind. When you think of the instinctive mind, this is kind of like it sounds, it's what I feel. I feel this is right. Inside me, I have a feeling that this is right, that it's based on some unknowable quantity that or unknowable information that just in my head, you see this and yes, this is right or that is wrong. It's instinctual. It's built into me. And you couldn't necessarily describe why do you believe this. You would just say, it's just what I believe. It's deep down inside. The other one is your inquisitive brain or your logical brain. It's like, I believe that the earth is round because in the science books that I read say it's round. The pictures that I've seen from outer space say it's round. And this is my logical brain telling me that everything I have been taught is true, and therefore that is a logical idea that I hold in my head. Now, I probably have a few friends listening to this that maybe disagree about the earth. You know, maybe they believe the earth is flat because they would say, that's what I can see. When I look out over the ocean, I see a flat earth. And so they're holding on to what they consider to be a logical thought process that they can see and test. And so we're at odds. And what I'm saying, and what the book said, more than likely, most of the things we believe are instinctual, not necessarily intellectual or logical. that most of the things that we believe are an instinct. Now, there can be some logic, there can be some schooling, there can be some authority that have told us these things, but when we really bury a belief deep down inside, it's probably much more on the instinctive mind than it is on the logical mind. And one of the problems we have in management and leadership and parenting is most of the time when we're trying to influence somebody or try to change their mind, we're using logic and reason when it was emotion and instinct that buried that belief deep down inside. So I have two. I have two beliefs that were challenged, and one was logical or inquisitive. The other was very much instinctive. And the first one was a logical, inquisitive, and it involves my job. I'm a paramedic, and when I went to paramedic school, an EMT school, there was something that we did on almost every single patient, and it was drilled into my head. So much so that when we would test, if you failed this one thing, this one item, you could get everything else right. But if you didn't do this one thing, you would fail the scenario. You wouldn't get a state test. I mean, it was drilled in. And that was, if somebody falls, you put a cervical collar on their neck, those big, you know, the big white collar, plastic collar, put that on. You held on to their neck with your hands until you put them on a backboard, strapped them down to the backboard, and strapped their head down to the backboard. If you didn't do that, you failed. It was like they are going to be paralyzed instantly. Like they put the fear of God into every EMT paramedic that ever went through training from when they started in the 70s right up until probably 2013 or 14 or so. This was drilled into us. I mean, old lady falls off her recliner, the foot and a half to the floor, we would go, protocol. So, and we had to, right? This was protocol. Someone falls from a certain distance, you put a C collar on, you hold their neck, you put them on a backboard, you transport them to the hospital on a backboard. Drilled into me. Like, I cannot tell you, like, the first thing you do, walk up, is the scene safe? Yes. Do I have my universal precautions? Like, am I wearing gloves and glasses? Yes. Next thing, you almost, even if it was like a diabetic emergency, you grab their C-spine just to make sure you weren't messing it up, right? Until you could rule out that they didn't fall. So drilled into my head, really, really important. And then sometime between 2010 and 2014, I don't remember the date, they started coming out with these studies going, man, maybe we were wrong about this whole C-collar backboard thing. Maybe this was not, so they started doing some research. What was this based on? What study? And they found out it was a study in California, super small sample size, just, you know, dozens of patients that may have had a spinal cord injury because their spinal cord wasn't stabilized, but there was like, they really didn't dial it in. So they did a much more robust study. And what they found was we were doing more harm than good by holding someone's neck still, putting them on a rigid backboard, and then transporting to the hospital. One of the reasons is you can secure someone's head to a backboard extremely well. It's, you know, you tape it down and it doesn't move. But their body, there's lots of gaps. It's hard to get it to a backboard. So you can strap that down, but not as good. So now you have someone with maybe a neck injury with their head secured and their body going down the road, going left and right, all the way down, bouncing the road, and their head can't move with their body to keep things in line. And they just nixed it. They said, we're not using backboards unless you just need them to physically move somebody, and then you get them off the backboard when you put them on your stretcher. Now, it used to be, if someone got in a car accident, ma'am, don't move your head. I'm going to come up. Don't look at me. I'm going to walk to the side. I'm going to grab your neck so it doesn't move. Put a C-collar on, put them on a backboard. Now, if we show up, we say, ma'am, do you have neck pain? They said, yeah, we put a C-collar on. I said, if you feel comfortable, can you stand up and sit down on our stretcher? And they say, yeah, of course. They sit down. I had to change my mind. And this is what was very interesting, though. I went through school, became a paramedic, and I was a busy paramedic. I mean, as a firefighter paramedic in the city I worked in, we did more calls, at least as many calls as anybody else. I mean, we were super busy. I've done 23 calls in a 24-hour shift one time, just driving through the station like it wasn't even there, just going at one after another. So I was lots of experience. And roughly the 2 or 3 year mark, I started to question, like, man, we're putting some of these old people, especially people that are really hunched over, have, you know, scoliosis or whatever, their backs are real rounded. We're putting them on a backboard and, man, they seem so uncomfortable. It seems to create lots of pain and discomfort. And then, you know, if they didn't have back pain, by the time they rode to the hospital on a backboard, sat on a backboard for an hour till the doctor cleared them, their backs were killing them. And I thought, man, this doesn't seem right. Like I don't think we should be doing this, but the protocol and the logical part of my brain was like, no, they said from the very first day, if you don't do this, people are going to be paralyzed and they're never going to walk again. And it was deep down inside. And then they said, hey, you know what? We made a mistake. We're going to let you do this. And I knew that was right. When they said, this is the data, this is what we think, this is what we want you to do, I knew as soon as they appealed to the logic of it, I'm like, yeah, I've seen it in my life. Like I got further in my career. I felt a little more confident with how things were going. I would lead people away from saying they had neck or back pain because I didn't want them to have to go to the hospital on a backboard. I was just, man, this seems so mean to put someone on a backboard who fell off a recliner because this is protocol. And so when I changed my mind, it was an appeal to my logic. This is the study. This is why. And then my instincts were actually correct in that. I had the instinct that we're not helping people by putting everybody on a backboard. Now, bad car accidents, that was a little bit more logical to me, and we stopped doing it. And this is the real part. This is the strange part about change. Even though logically it made sense, and I started doing it because we're protocol driven and I had to do it, that probably for another 2, 3, 4 years, when I didn't put somebody on a backboard, I felt like I was doing something wrong at a moral level. It was deep down inside that, man, this doesn't seem right. We're not putting them on a backboard. And guys would even start to do it again, put someone on a backboard, like, hey, we don't do that anymore. Like, it's not something we do. And it felt wrong. Like, I almost wanted to, I was talking to another buddy. I'm like, didn't it almost feel like you were sinning? Like this was like a core belief that, and I had to change. So that change happened because they appealed to my logic, because that's how I learned. I learned in school, the authoritative figure told me this is what's true. And then they wound it back. They said, you know what? We've made a mistake. Here's the study. Here's why we think you should do what you're doing. And I would change. Now, that was a tough change for me to make because it didn't feel right. Just didn't feel right because it was something I learned logically, or my intuitive mind or inquisitive mind learned that. So they appealed to my inquisitive mind, gave me the data, and I changed. That's scenario number one. Scenario number two, another time of change. This was a very instinctual change, very instinctual. And that was the fact that I did not like country music. I thought country music was garbage. If you said, do you like country music? I would say, no, there is nothing I like about country music. That was why? I mean, because the pop country, you know, the Shania Twain, the Way Down Yonder on the Chattahoochee just didn't appeal to me. You know, I got friends in low places. I couldn't like it. I just thought it was any song about, you know, drinking beer on the tailboard of your truck and your dog ran away. I just didn't like it. I thought it was garbage. And then randomly, I don't know where I first heard it, but I heard Chris Stapleton and I went, whoa, what is that? And it was on a country station, or it was a country Pandora. I'm like, who's that guy? That is good. I like that. And then I looked and I'm like, he's a country singer? No way. And I made on Pandora, I made a Chris Stapleton channel. And I started hearing people similar to what Chris Stapleton was, the Steely Dans, and just the message they were sharing. Like, it was real words and they were telling stories and the music was good. And it was, the guitar playing was amazing. I'm like, and I hit it. I wouldn't listen to it around people that I knew because I don't want them to think that I like country music, because that would change who I was. I was the person who didn't like country music, who said openly country music is garbage. I had to change my beliefs, right? Because that was instinctual. It wasn't logical. There's no reason. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Chris Stapleton had been out for quite a while. I just heard him for the first time. But man, I really liked it. And it took me a while to openly say, if someone said, do you like country music? I say, yeah. I like people like Chris Stapleton, the Steely Dans. I like a message, a good message. Some of it's very moral. I just listened to one about the Buy Dirt song. I love that. You're going to buy dirt so you can build a family. You know, it's a good, wholesome message, good, you know, good stuff. And I had to change. And the way I changed was through the instinctual, right? I listened to this music and I knew I liked it. And I had to tell myself this was something good and it's okay to like country music. And I can say Chris Stapleton is one of my favorites, and the message and the music and the guitar playing, it's all good. And I'm okay with that. But that took me a long time because that belief was held instinctually. So therefore the music had to appeal to that part. Someone said that logically, like, hey, not all music is Shania Twain and, you know, this other real pop, like slash rap with a country accent. Like, it's not all that, it's this, but it took me a while to change. So that's the two ways that we hold beliefs. One is logical or inquisitive. The other is emotional or intuitive. So when you're appealing, so step one is to realize that you should be a person that changes. If you're the same person today as you were 10 years ago, you're probably failing because there's no way everything you believe is true. So I'm going to give you some tools and based on scenarios that I've dealt with as a leader and a father, that one was a logical fallacy, logical something that was taught and I had to change it. The other one was an emotional one. And I'm going to go through a few steps that are in this book, Mind Stuck. Again, I recommend the book. It's very good. I'm going to link to it in the description. So the first one was an issue we have at work, and it involves the way we put fire out, something the core value, the core skill we do as firefighters. When I first started, there was the dogma that when you go to a house that's on fire, you find the side of the house that is currently not burned. So if the back of the house is burned, you're going to go in through the front. If the front of the house is burned, you're going to go through the back. You're going to fight it from the unburned side. That was standard policy, procedure, protocol. And when you get inside the house, you're going to try to find the seat of the fire, meaning the things that are on fire, and you're going to get right up to, you can see the seat of the fire, and then, and only then, are you going to put water on the fire. You're not going to spray the atmosphere. You're not going to cool the smoke. We don't spray smoke. We spray fire. And that was something deeply held, and it was something I was taught in the fire academy, and then it was taught heavily by senior firefighters, which I highly respected, telling me this is what good, aggressive, interior firefighting is. Fast forward 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years into my career, Underwriters Laboratory started doing some tests and go, well, what if instead of trying to get to the seat of the fire, we put water in through windows and cooled the fire from the outside and we cooled the atmosphere. What if the smoke that we're crawling underneath, what if we cooled that atmosphere as we're going in? What would that look like? And they did studies and research, and they found that the atmosphere conditions with just a little bit of water dropped drastically, dropped from totally unsurvivable to maybe survivable. And so they started putting out this message, and it was a logical message. They could show you thermal imaging of the temperature, putting water into the atmosphere and watching it cool. And this was a logical message, but it didn't take in many places. And the guys that I work with didn't believe it, didn't embrace it. And I had to do two things. This was a logical message, right? And part of the way we believed it is because we were taught it, right? So that's on the logic side. But the other part, there was some emotion. And so one of the things you need to do when you are going to change somebody's mind is you need to kind of go through a few steps. And one of the steps, the first one is to not change their mind, to get that out of your head. I'm not trying to change your mind on when we should or shouldn't spray smoke. What I'm actually trying to do is to get you to think. Because if someone's really heavily grounded, and especially if they get it on an emotional level, if they believe something because it's an instinct, it's very hard for you to change their mind. So the first goal is don't try to change their mind. Try to get them to think. And that is a success. Because ultimately, you can't change their mind. You influence them to change their own mind. And sometimes when we go into a scenario, we see it as a win-lose. If I'm going to change your mind and I win. And you might even change their mind for a little bit. And like, yeah, I see what you're saying. It's all logical. All makes sense. All right, yeah, I agree with you. But they probably don't. They're saying that because you made more good points and they're conceding and they win, or you win and they lose. And nobody wants to be a loser. So don't try to win. Try to get them to think. And when someone can think critically and then the emotions line up and the logic lines up, then you're doing okay. So that's step one. Step two is I had to understand why these guys believe what they believe. Is this a logical belief or is this an emotional belief? And what I found out, because I had looked at myself, is it was both. I was taught this, and I believe that aggressive firefighters are guys that go inside burning buildings. We don't spray water from the outside, and we don't spray smoke because that's not aggressive. So once I understood where people are coming from, I understood their motivations, their thinking, their reasoning. I was able to appeal to both those sides. Number three, find the common ground. You could be completely opposed to somebody. Let's take a subject like abortion, hot topic in the country right now. The whole Roe v. Wade, all that, you know, just it's polarizing. Find something. Maybe you're totally pro-choice. Maybe you're pro-life. Whatever it is, find something that you can agree with, and then that's at least a good starting point. For instance, most people would say that it is unethical, immoral, to kill a baby at 39 weeks and 6 days. At 40 weeks is when they're going to come out. The day before they're going to be delivered, to reach in and to destroy that baby. Most people. Now, some people don't. I understand there's a difference there. But most people would say, yeah, that doesn't seem right. Wow. That's all. You both can agree on something, on a polarizing issue, and then work towards that. So for the firefighting, my common belief was we need to be aggressive. We need to be lifesavers that go in, and we're not cowards. Can we both agree? Yeah, I want to be aggressive. Do you want to save lives? Yeah, I want to save lives. We're not cowards, are we? No, we're not cowards. We're going to go to work. And then the fourth thing you can do is harness the hypothetical. So what I had to do with the guys, and it was a slow process, and I also had to learn who I needed to win, right? Win over. I shouldn't say win, because we're not trying to win. I'm trying to change, get them to think. It was the officers. It wasn't the firefighters. It was the guys in charge of the firefighters. So I started thinking, hey, you know, we had the fire the other day, and we're outside. There was fire blowing out the second story window. We know we're going to go in the front door. We put out all the fire, and then we crawled. Then we went underneath the fire that was upstairs. What do you think would have happened if we would have put water through that window for maybe just 30 seconds? And you get them to think, get them to tell you why that is or isn't a good idea. And then it gives you something to talk about, as opposed to saying, you guys know that the study says if we would have put 30 seconds worth of water in that window, survivability rates would have increased by 20%. Temperatures would have dropped by 50%. That's not helpful for me to feed that stuff to them. I can ask them. They're like, well, maybe it cooled off. You think it would have been easier to find the stairs? Maybe it wouldn't be so hot up there when we got there, and we'd be able to move a little more aggressively. Yeah, I can see that. So we found some common ground, and then we can work on that. Now, one of the problems that I had is the perception of putting water from the outside was cowardly. And what some other departments had fallen back on is they called it hitting it hard from the yard, which is what science was saying, is that they want you to put water into a window from the outside if there's fire showing for just a brief period of time. It cools the temperature. Well, some departments, and I will say being overly risk adverse, not understanding the priority or the idea that we're supposed to go inside and find the people that are in the building, they wouldn't go inside. They're going to do all their firefighting from the outside, and I don't think that's right at all. In fact, I think it's dead wrong. We are firefighters, and our number one priority is to find survivable people that can survive inside these burning buildings, and the only place that you can find them is inside the building. So we need to get in there and find these victims. Back in the day, we would just go in without putting any water from the outside. So what I had to sell the guys is like, hey, I'm not telling you to be a coward. I'm not telling you to be a punk and we're only going to fight fire from the outside. I'm telling you, I want you to be overly aggressive. And if you see a fire coming out of a window, I want you to put 30 seconds of water into that window so that we can be overly, even more aggressive inside quicker, and we can find victims that are actually survived and not recoveries where people have died because of the heat and smoke exposure. Let's give them every chance. And the way we do that is if you see fire blowing out a window, every window that has fire coming out gets 30 seconds of water before we make our push inside, and that makes it more survivable. And so we can be more aggressive. In order to do that, how do we? Well, we got to be good. We got to train. We got to get really good at getting the hose off the truck and getting water supply so we don't run out. So I sold them on, I want you to do everything you've been doing, and this is just maybe a new way to think about it. What's the hypothetical? Well, maybe we cool the temperature. Maybe we can be more aggressive. Maybe buildings where we went in and got overcome by fire and had to back out and go defensive, meaning we're never going to go back in. Maybe if we would have put a little bit of water out, we would have been a little bit faster getting it, and then we can save more people. So I had to appeal to the hypothetical of what if, and let them kind of come up with that. And maybe, obviously, I have a wanted outcome, but I'm guiding them. And that's the last step is if you can get them to say, this is a good idea, or this is a bad idea, or this is that, and it's based on common thought that you can both agree on, you're going to get them to change their thinking. And if they change their thinking, eventually they might change their mind because it was their idea. So then instead of me trying to influence the 13, 14 firefighters in my district, I'm influencing four officers. Those officers are going to go, and they're looked up to and well-respected. At the next fire, they're going to go, hey, before we go inside this burning building, there's fire shooting out the second floor. Hit that real quick. They're going to hit it. They're going to go in, and they're going to see a change. They're going to go in. It's going to not be as hot. They're going to be faster. They're going to get a grab. They're going to save a life. And they're going to go, man, that was a good idea. I'm glad I thought of that. And I'm going to think, yes, you're right. You had such a great idea. Because ultimately, as someone in charge, as a leader, that's what I want, right? I want my guys to be effective. I want them to get the wins. I want them to pull people out and be excited about their job and be proud of how aggressive and hardcore, whatever the good thing is. I want them to have that. And if I can get them to do that and it was their idea, did I win? I did. We all won. We were better, faster, quicker, aggressive. And that is the power of changing minds. And I'm still doing this. Like if you're one of my buddies listening to this, I know we haven't done this because I've tried. I've had fires where everybody went inside like a moth to a flame, and I tried to pull some guys out, put some water in, it didn't work. But we're working. We go back and we this is a process, right? Because I could influence them and order them, stop, don't go inside the building. I want you to spray water and give them all these detailed orders, but that's micromanagement. No one wants to be micromanaged. That's not an effective way. So it's a slow process. I want them to come up with it. You know, I want to have this change of mind, which eventually change habits, actions, and leads to success. So that is one way that I've dealt with this. The other one is as a parent. As a parent in 2024, as your children get into those teenage years, you're going to experience this. And this is something you can't talk to your mom and dad about, more than likely because they didn't deal with it, is social media. When my son turned 13, he started asking, hey, do you think I maybe could get like Instagram? And I said, no. 14, can I get Instagram? Again, no. But we had this conversation. He really wanted it. It was important to him. I didn't really know. You know, I wasn't sure. So we still said, no, you can't have it. Getting closer to 15, he really wants Instagram. He wants to get on Instagram. And I felt deep down in my soul that this was a bad thing. That was my mindset. Now, I didn't just say no, right? I reached out to some well-respected parents that were also counselors. They, you know, one was a doctor, one has their master's. And what do you guys think? They said, well, this is the way they interact as human beings. Where you might have spent the night at your buddy's house, they're going to be chatting on Instagram. They're going to be posting with each other. They're going to be doing these things. And they're going to get it when they get old enough. When they no longer have to ask you, they're going to get it. And one way to ensure that they maybe have some good tools, resources, and understand how to use it as a tool is to give it to them now and have it highly supervised. So I had to be willing to change my mind. So we gave them Instagram. Fast forward now, my son wanted Snapchat. And I had all the reasons in the world to say no. And I'll tell you now, I have not changed my mind. No is still my answer. And I wouldn't say we had arguments, but we had heated discussions on why he should have it, or he thought why he should have it and why I didn't. And I didn't follow this process to start. I came up with all the logical reasons, and they're good reasons. I said, buddy, there's nothing good that can come up of your pictures and messages disappearing in 30 minutes or an hour or however long it takes on Snapchat for them just to go away. I'm like, that is just bad. You'll never convince me. And I went over all the facts and all the details. And he said, you don't understand. I'm not getting invited to things because I'm not on Snapchat and people are not messaging me. Like I missed a party because the invitations went out on Snapchat and nobody told me about it. And he's got these emotions, right? And you have Instagram and they can text message you and you can get WhatsApp. I'm like, I didn't understand the emotion behind. I'm like, no, it's not logical. You don't need Snapchat. You don't need it. You don't need it. You don't need it. I'm just beating them up with facts. And he is emotionally telling me that because I don't have Snapchat, I am missing out on social interactions, which as a teenager is probably the most important thing you could ever hope to have is social interaction, right? His friends and the way they think of him and view him are everything. And so, you know, multiple conversations, multiple days, it finally hit me. Like, this kid doesn't care that I have all these logical reasons why we're not getting Snapchat. And what I had to realize was I'm not going to change his mind. I'm not going to completely, he's going to want Snapchat. And when he's 18, he'll probably get it. And myself and my wife, we actually changed tactics a little bit. And it wasn't a conscious thought like, oh, I need to be appealed to his emotions because I hadn't read this book yet. It was, why is he not understanding me? And so we started to appeal to our emotions. And we started to tell him why we were concerned. And then I also had to realize that we probably weren't going to agree. And I wasn't going to change his mind completely, but I wanted him to think. And the success happened when I said, instead of saying all the logical reasons, I started telling him the way I would feel if something bad happened. I would say, you know, hey, bud, what if somebody sends an inappropriate picture of one of your female friends to you? Could you ever see them the same? Would you view them differently if you saw, you know, a picture with their top off or something that you know is inappropriate and then your friends and it's not wrong, even though the picture went away, you're always going to be influenced by that. And your relationship with that person is going to change. And I don't want that for you. I would feel so sad if you had a relationship. And when I started appealing to his emotions, it didn't remove his want for the app. It didn't remove that want because he still had those feelings. But once I got him to see my point of view and my emotions, his mindset changed and he started to think, my parents aren't telling me no because they're terrible, evil people. They're telling me no because they feel a certain way. And as soon as he got that, and as soon as we shared those feelings with you, like, hey, bud, we're just trying to protect your mind and the things you see, and we can't do that on Snapchat because people are going to send things, they're more likely to send things that are inappropriate, and we want to protect you from that. He was okay with it. Now, I know he hasn't changed his mind. If I said, hey, today, bud, you can go get Snapchat, he would get it in a heartbeat. But he thought enough, and he has stopped asking, and he's okay with being under our decision, I think, because I appealed to the right process, right? You know, I try to find some common ground, but I want you to be able to interact with your friends. Can you talk to them and say, hey, can you send this on Instagram? Can you text message me? Can you let them know? You know, if you want to put it on me, say my parents are, they're mean and they won't give me Snapchat. So can you go out of your way to send it to me on all the other messaging apps, which logically makes sense to me, but whatever, I'm an old man. And that was really helpful. And it was successful, not because I won or he won, right? Because neither of us, winning for me would him to go, yeah, dad, you guys are so smart. I don't need Snapchat. What was I thinking? Yeah, I'm, you know, in fact, let me just get rid of all social media. Life would be better anyways. That didn't happen. But he did understand our feelings. And that's important. And that was influence. And I felt successful as a man, as a husband, as a father, as a leader. I want you to hone these skills. I want you to, you know, try to find common ground, try to appeal to hypothetical what ifs, you know, and let them come up with their idea and let it be their idea. And then realize there might be times where you aren't going to change someone's mind. And really, you probably shouldn't be. The goal should be to just get them to think. So go get your friends to think, go get your kids to think, go get your coworkers to think. And that's success in exercise this tool. So if you can come up with the power of influence, the ability to do this correctly, where they feel like it's a win, that they feel like it's their idea, you have solved the problem to all the world's issues, right? If we can influence people, right? If you can influence the world, you can change the world. And, changing the world, changing your world, your family, your friends, your kids is just, I think it's our responsibility to help keep people on the right track. Realize that you need to change. Be that person that goes, you know what? I'm going to change something. I'm going to start to like name the music you hate. You know, like I'm going to come up with something and make it a practice. You didn't fail. You changed, right? That's important. The only people that stop changing are the people that are dead, right? You're changing until you die. If you feel stagnant, you're probably dying. If you haven't changed in years, find an idea, explore the idea, change the idea. So this has been the Earn Your Title Podcast. My name is Danny Dumas. I have one request for you. 5,000 downloads has been awesome. If you could leave me a review on Apple or Spotify, wherever it is you watch these or listen to these, it would really help. I'd love to hear what you have to say so I can improve. I'd love 5 stars or the best, be honest. So leave me a review. Again, this is Danny Dumas, the Earn Your Title Podcast, and I will talk to you later. Bye.